Congratulations! You're listening to a Radio 1 91 FM podcast.
We're going to be joined by Associate Professor Tim Hoare to talk about the viability of the Gene Technology Bill, which has been doing the rounds across the newscape in recent memory. If you're not too familiar with the Gene Technology Bill, it is an omnibus bill designed to make a new law. It's about to enable the safe use of gene technology and regulated organisms in Aotearoa, New Zealand. The political consensus is that the current regime, which was put in 1996, does not really serve the industry or Aotearoa New Zealand very well. It needs an update. The question is, what can that update look like? So that's what we're going to be talking about with Tim Hoare in our new segment, Experts for Dummies.
Yes?
Do you need an expert to tell you things?
Yes.
Do you need help?
Okay, never mind. Sometimes Radio 1's very own breakfast host, Zach Hoffman, talks to experts so us dummies can learn a thing or two. Here's an expert now.
Here is an expert now. We've got Tim Hoare in the studio. Good morning to you. How are we?
Kia ora. Good to be here. Thanks very much.
I'm glad to have you, Tim. I'm very, very glad to have you. We're trying to get more science-y chats here on Breakfast.
Awesome.
And we're gonna kick off the science chat by asking, what is the prettiest part of the Maniototo region where you're originally from?
Oh,
it's very, very inland Otago, high plainsy area.
What's
the vibe?
Oh, I've got to say, you can't beat St. Bethan's in the Hawkden region, Otiaki Park. Absolutely stunning, wide open spaces, more blue sky than you've seen. Yeah, and at night, the stars are incredible.
Nice. Do you go back there very often?
Oh, yeah, probably once every 6 weeks, I reckon.
Nice.
Yeah, but I like it here on the Otago Peninsula too.
Mm-hmm. The Otago Peninsula is gorgeous. We're not spoilt for vistas around the Dunedin area, are we?
Yeah, that's right.
It's fantastic. Now, let's talk about this Gene Technology Bill. A common criticism of Aotearoa adopting genetically modified organisms in a broad way when it comes to agriculture is that it could ruin our organic or slash naturally branded exports as they'd be labelled GMO. Is that really the case?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, and I think this is probably the most credible challenge to what's happening in the gene technology space at the moment. But what I would say is, let's just look to Australia. Like, Australia is where, gene technology regulation is what our gene technology bill is based off of, mm-hmm. almost entirely. Mm-hmm. So look to them, and what you do if you look there, you can see that there's organic producers working alongside people who are growing genetically modified crops, for example, mm-hmm. And it hasn't destroyed their organics industry. They've had that regulation in place for 25 years,
And they're still ticking along.
Man. There hasn't been any huge disasters. We have what you might call a late adopter's advantage. Mm-hmm. Every other economy and country that we compare ourselves to has adopted these kind of regulations that are being proposed. So we can look at them, we can learn from them, and not make the same mistakes that they have. But to be honest, there hasn't really been too many issues in Australia. That's really where we're looking to getting this regulation together.
Mm-hmm. So the Australian legislation is called the Gene Technology Act 2000, which allows for gene technology to be developed and researched and released as products, and it also establishes a regulator to oversee and provide accountability on gene technology matters. Just how close is our legislation to the Australian one? Is it one-to-one, essentially?
Oh, it's getting close to that. I mean, the most important thing, and I really must stress this, the most important difference between what we have now and the Australian system is a certain amount of primary legislation, so acts put into law. At the moment, all of our regulation is basically in what's known as the HASNO Act, so Hazardous Substances and New Organisms, mm-hmm. and it's defined in law, so it's really hard to change. But in the Australian system, they have secondary legislation sitting underneath that, and that means that it's easier to change the rules so that it can respond to new technologies. We've had, brand new technology known as CRISPR-Cas9 and other technologies where you can go in and change the genetic code in a very specific manner. And this has come along since the HasNo Act, and we don't really have the legislation to deal with it effectively. So that's why we need an Australian-like system where there's primary legislation, but most importantly, secondary legislation where it can be tweaked in order to respond to changing technologies, changing needs.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about the Australian Act for a second, and I'm going to be a little bit long-winded. In a 2004 review in the Asia-Pacific Journal of Environmental Law, some academics criticised the Australian Gene Technology Bill for its ideological basis on dogmatically assuming that the benefits of genetic engineering outweigh its risks, providing little remedial liability recourse if the environment or someone is harmed from a GE product, and for giving GE applicants greater rights of review for a refused application than the public does when a genetic engineering license is issued. Does our New Zealand bill pose the similar risks, and do you think that these are risks?
Yeah, so what the Gene Technologies Bill is trying to do is to be risk proportionate and enabling. That's the two things that they're setting out to be risk proportionate and enabling. We are definitely not risk proportionate in New Zealand. I chair the Biological Safety Committee here at the university, and a lot of the work that we do here is very, very safe in containment on organisms that can't live outside the laboratory, right? So it's really safe. Mm. But they're treated in a very heavy-handed regulatory sense, even though they couldn't ever form a self-sustaining population. It's at the moment it's definitely not risk proportionate. As to the enabling part, there's only three, I think, genetically modified products available in New Zealand that we make. We consume a lot of genetically modified products that come from overseas, but we don't make any ourselves. It's not enabling. Coming back to your original question about the Australian system, 2004 is again 20 years ago. It's quite.
It's quite a long time ago.
I would say that the system over there in the past 20 to 25 years has been tested, and you know it's moving along fine, and that's why we should be looking to Australia to see how well it's going to work for us and what it could enable.
Mm. There's a lot of concern in the sort of anti-GMO genetic engineering crowd around the use of genetic use restriction technology, which produces products which kind of terminate themselves, whether that be their next generation is infertile or the next generation loses its desired traits. Now, this can be great when you're looking at eradicating invasive pests or preventing screwworms from reaching North America. But when it comes to selling seeds that, you know, kind of terminate themselves over time, farmers have to keep buying more seeds from big agro companies like Monsanto. Yeah. It's pretty dubious stuff, really. Would our regime allow such things to be researched?
Yes, of course. That's an economic matter, what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer to this is actually quite simple. The majority of places that do genetic modification research in New Zealand and also in Australia are public institutions, and they should be doing things for the public good.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing stopping researchers like me or the 150-odd principal investigators at the University of Otago who have the capacity to do this kind of work to create seeds that help people, help farmers, but don't self-terminate. There's no reason why that can't be done, and this is actually most of the gene technology work that's done in Australia, for example, is focused on those kind of things. It's not so much these days the likes of Monsanto and those kind of big companies who are driving a lot of it. A lot of it's coming from public institutions, and you know, there's no reason why it can't be for the public good.
Do you know if there's quite a big demand for private research into GMOs here in Aotearoa, or is it mostly public?
Mostly public, yeah. I mean, the private stuff that could be done, well, people might look at it and say, well, actually, the legislation's too hard to get anything done. We're not going to bother.
Mm-hmm.
That's the simple answer, really. So we import, all of these GM products, but we don't make any of our own. And I'm talking about like cotton, the clothes that we wear, a lot of that's gene modified. A lot of the soybean products that we consume are from genetically modified soy, and a lot of the animal feeds that we import are also genetically modified. So, you know, it's not like we don't consume a whole lot of it. We do. It's just that we're not participating in the creation.
We're just kind of missing out in a way.
Well,
it depends on how you look at it.
Yeah.
And being a treaty partner, the government would establish a Māori advisory committee to provide non-binding recommendations on certain GE areas, in particular with species, non-Indigenous and Indigenous, that Māori have a kaitiaki relationship with. If this advice is non-binding, is it entering sort of Waitangi Tribunal space where it can provide really, really good recommendations, but just be listened to by deaf ears?
Yeah, it's a great question. So what I would say to that, in the legislation at the moment, what they're saying is they must consider the advice from a technical advisory committee and a Māori advisory committee.
Mm-hmm.
So they must consider, and you're right, it's non-binding. But what I would say is that from the technical perspective, it's exactly the same as the Māori. There's technical risk and there's social risk,
mm-hmm.
right? And neither of those two things are binding, right? So that regulator has to make a decision on the basis of the advice given to them and the full picture,
mm-hmm.
And they must consider it. The Māori Advisory Committee is non-binding, but also from a technical perspective, it's non-binding as well. So,
should there be an Environmental Advisory Committee?
That's a good question. When it comes to release, I guess, so you've really got to separate things that are being done in containment versus things that are for release, and mm-hmm. I think this is where quite a bit of the controversy is around release.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a big deal if everything's in containment.
Mm-hmm.
But the regulator, that technical advisory committee would be considering environmental risks as well, I think, and also the regulator, so it should be covered by that, yeah.
Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment Simon Upton, in a submission for the Select Committee, he outlined some key problems with the bill as it sits. He wants to ensure that all gene technologies that are to be released into the environment are risk assessed by the regulator before release, or for low risk ones are required to be registered with the regulator, to also ensure greater independence of the regulator and allow a wider range of people and entities to request reviews of the regulator's decisions, and introduce a civil liability regime. He criticised the government for not baking in risk parameters. What do you make of these recommendations?
I think some of them are sensible enough. Can you list those out again? I haven't read his.
No worries. He wants to ensure that all gene technologies that are to be released into the environment are risk assessed by the regulator before release. He also wants the regulator to have more independence, and he wants to allow a wider range of people and entities to request reviews of the regulator's decisions. He also wants to introduce a civil liability regime.
Yeah, so in terms of the register, that was one of the things that was picked up by the Select Committee and is being introduced. But this is entirely sensible, I think. When it comes to some of those things that are exceptionally low risk, so they look basically like conventional techniques, but they've been, just in the way that they've been made, they've involved gene technologies and therefore need to be regulated. Some might say that that's a bit heavy-handed. So to give you an example of this, there's a gene mutation in cattle known as the slick skin mutation. It's there already in breeds that are in the tropics.
Mm-hmm.
And you could either breed that in by crossing it, or you could create it with gene technologies. So the outcome is very, you know, exceptionally low risk, because we could get to the same point using simple breeding. But using gene technologies, we might be able to get there a whole lot quicker, and that will help us to be more resilient for climate change and things like that. So the question becomes, for a thing like that where it's exceptionally safe, does it really need registration before it is released out into farming and for consumers to consume it, when ultimately the output, the product, is exactly the same as what we could have got through
in nature.
Through conventional techniques.
Yeah.
So you might say that that's potentially heavy-handed, whereas others would say, well, this is still gene modification using advanced technology, so we should be worried about it. But that's really the point, I think, and that's what a lot of people who were submitting to the Select Committee don't really get, I think, is that there's a huge spectrum of things that can be done using gene technologies, and some of them are exceptionally safe and no different to conventional selective breeding or mutagenesis screens that have been going on for years and years to make better crops.
Mm-hmm.
That's the big difference.
And New Zealand has been a late adopter of many technologies. We only had television come to Aotearoa in about the 60s. Are you excited that the ball is rolling for gene tech to at least have more of a space in our public science?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's going to could make a really huge difference for us. The anecdote I like to give is when it comes to science in New Zealand, the powerhouses of research in New Zealand are PhD students and postdoctoral researchers. They're on contracts, postdocs are on contracts for generally 2 to 5 years. PhD students take 3 years. There was a very simple, low-risk application that fell out of the Has No Act, meaning that special permission was required, and it took literally 2 postdoc contracts, so, you know, greater than 6 years to get this thing passed. It was a simple virus that only infected the cell that you put it in and the cell beside it. Like, it couldn't spread outside of the lab, it couldn't do anything, really. It was completely safe. But the researcher that got the money, the person that they'd hired to do this experiment, got through their first postdoc, couldn't do the experiment, got through their second postdoc, obviously had to find something else to do.
Oh, my God.
And then eventually they went back to France and continued their research over there.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is the, like, classic reason why things have got to change.
That's the problem in a nutshell.
Yeah. So there's the work that has been stopped, but then there's also the creativity and sort of the opportunity costs. People don't take on creative, exciting, bold projects in this space because they just know that it can't ever be used. Some of the boldest work that we're doing at the university, this could unlock it. Yeah.
And that would be awesome. That would be very exciting. Thank you for coming on the program, Tim. I really appreciate it.
Kia ora, Jack. Thanks very much.
Kia ora. That was Tim Hoare, Associate Professor at the University of Otago, Otago Whakaihu Waka. We're going to be happy.
That was a Radio 191 FM podcast. Find more at r1.co.nz.